Lecture 4 of the Esoteric Aspect of the Social Question, March 9th, 1919. There is great significance in the way certain people feel compelled today to speak of the human situation. People who are endeavoring with their feelings and perceptions, at least, to see into the heart of social affairs. To point to this significance, I would like to start with a few statements from the address Kurt Eisner gave to a gathering of students in Basel shortly before his death. Perhaps some of you have already heard these statements, but they are extraordinarily significant if you want to grasp the symptomatic nature of certain things today. Quote, "I hear, don't I?" he said, referring to his previous remarks. "And I see clearly enough that deep down there is a longing in our lives, striving to come to expression, which recognizes clearly enough that our life, as we have to live it today, is nothing more than an obvious invention of some evil spirit. Imagine a great thinker living about 2,000 years ago and knowing nothing about our time, dreaming of how the world would look in 2,000 years. Not with the most vivid imagination would he have been able to think up a world such as the one in which we are condemned to live. In truth, existing conditions are the only utopia, quote, in the world, and the substance of our desires, our longing of the spirit, is the deepest and final reality. And everything else is horrible. We are simply confusing dreaming and waking. It is up to us to shake off this ancient dream of our present-day social existence. One glance at the war. Can you imagine anyone with human intelligence devising anything of that kind? If this has not been what we call reality, then perhaps it was a dream and we are now awakening." Unquote. Just think of it. This man, in his efforts to understand the present, was driven to make use of the idea of dreaming and to ask himself, is it not much better to call the reality surrounding us today a bad dream than to call it actual reality? So we have this remarkable case, and think how typical it is of a thoroughly modern person, someone who felt himself to be a herald of a new age, regarding outer sense reality, not altogether as Maya, as a dream, as for instance the Indian point of view does, but feeling impelled, in face of the exceptional events of the present, to raise the question, no matter in what sense, but nevertheless to raise it, whether we are not actually dreaming this reality. Indeed, the whole tenor of Eisner's address shows that he was using more than a turn of phrase when he said that this present reality can be nothing else but something inflicted upon humankind by an evil spirit. Let us take some of the things to which we have given our minds in the course of our anthroposophical work, especially the fact that in general, we endeavor to look at outer sense reality not as the whole of reality, but as being connected with supersensible reality, without which it would not be complete. This outlook, however, is no more than a tiny spark in the currents of thought, of the present age, which to a large extent is flooded by materialistic thinking. Yet we see that a man such as Kurt Eisner, who from his point of view gave this spark no credit, at any rate not during his lifetime, but is still driven by the facts of his time to the one and only comparison he can make. Outer reality, in its present appearance at least, is a dream. Faced with this present-day reality, he is forced to make a confession which he can only express in terms of the universal truth of the unreal nature, the Maya character of outer sense reality on its own. Let us now go rather more deeply into some of the things we have been considering over the past weeks, which have included the social question. Let us observe how the trend of events in recent centuries has brought people more and more to the point of denying the actual spiritual or supersensible world, and upholding this denial to the greatest possible extent. You may object that in some quarters people talk a lot about the supersensible world. There are still numerous churches, if not always full, would resound, at least, with words that profess to announce the spirit. After all, today and yesterday evening, we have been hearing the tolling of bells almost nonstop, and that is supposed to be the expression of what is presented to the world as spiritual life. Yet we experience something else besides this. If right now, in the immediate present, an endeavor is being made to listen to what the Christ is saying to our present age, then it is precisely the adherents of the old religious communities who make the fiercest attacks on this form of spiritual revelation. Real spiritual life, one that relies not merely on faith or on ancient tradition, but on the direct spiritual findings of the present, is something very, very few people want today. In the light of this, is it not in actual fact as though modern humanity needs to be pushed, not by an evil cosmic spirit, perhaps, but by a good cosmic spirit, to think again of the spiritual side of existence, by being doomed to experience sense-perceptible reality of such a kind that a really modern person has to say of it that it resembles a dream, and that even a great thinker of 2,000 years ago could not have imagined such a scenario as that which appears as outer reality today. At any rate, here is a modern person compelled to form different ideas about reality than the currently popular ones. I know that a large number of our anthroposophical friends have found it rather difficult to understand these particular ideas about actual reality, the importance of which I have been stressing today. But you will not be able to cope with life as it now is unless you have the goodwill to subscribe to different ideas, such as these. What kind of thoughts do people arrive at today in the following field? They hold a crystal in their hand and think of it as a real object. Then they hold a rose picked from its bush and call that also a real object. They call both of them real objects in the same sense. But are they both real in the same sense? Scientists, whether from their seats of learning, in their laboratories or clinics, all talk about reality in that they call things real only to the extent that they are real in the same sense as a crystal or a picked rose. But is there not a considerable difference, an enormous difference, between these two objects? Through the fact that over long ages of time, the crystal keeps its own form, whereas the rose loses its form and dies a comparatively short time after it has been picked. It does not have the same level of reality as the crystal. And even the rose bush, if it is dug up, does not have the same level of reality as it has when it is in the earth. So we shall, after all, have to look at the things of the world in a different way from today's way of looking at them from outside. We should not call a rose or a rose bush real. At the most, we can speak of reality if we take the whole earth into account, and the rose bush, as well as every flower on it, as a strand of hair growing out of the reality. You see from this that in external sense reality, there can be things which cease to be real in a true sense of the word if they are separated from their foundation. And this means that we have to start searching within what appears to be outer reality, this great illusion, for the true realities. In the study of nature, mistakes of this kind are common today. But anyone who makes this kind of mistake, and people have got used to this through centuries of habit, will find it extraordinarily hard to think about social matters in a way that accords with reality. For you see, the great difference between human life and nature is that in nature, anything that is no longer fully real, such as a picked rose, soon dies. Something that is not a reality can have the appearance of reality, yet in itself it is a lie. And we can quite well incorporate as a reality in social life something which in itself is no reality. In this case, although it is not bound to die off rapidly, it will gradually turn into a source of agony for humanity. For nothing can prove a blessing which is not first experienced and thought out as a complete reality before it is embedded into the social organism. It is not just a sin against the social order, but a sin against truth itself. If, and I have often said this, we assume human labor can be a commodity. In outer apparent reality, it can be made to seem so. But this illusion of reality will cause suffering in the human social order and set the stage for upheavals and revolutions in the social organism. To sum up, what people need to incorporate into their way of thinking today is that not everything manifested in the outer appearance of reality, such as we see within certain limits, is bound to be true reality. It may be a living lie. And this distinction between living truths and living lies is something that should be deeply engraved in people's conscious minds today. For the more people there are who take this distinction deeply seriously, and the more people there are in whom the feeling awakens that we must open our eyes to these things, which are not living lies, but living truths, the sooner will the social organism be restored to health. But for this to occur, what has to happen? It is no easy matter to know whether an external object is actually real or not. Imagine to yourselves a being coming from a planet on which the conditions are different from those on our earth, so that he had never encountered the difference between a rose growing on a bush and a crystal. If you were to present him with both a crystal and a rose, he might well believe that the two were equally real. He would then be surprised to find the rose withering so soon, while the crystal remained the same. Here on earth, we know about these differences because we have observed these things over a longer period, but we cannot follow everything up as we can with a rose to see in outer reality whether a thing is actually real or not. For in life, we are presented with things which require us to create a foundation for our judgment if we are to visualize their true reality. What sort of foundation is this, particularly where social life is concerned? In the two preceding lectures, I told you a few things about this foundation, and today I will add something more. You know from my books the descriptions I have given of the spiritual world, the world a human being experiences between death and a new birth. You know that when we refer to this life in the supersensible spiritual world, we need to be aware of the way in which souls relate to one another. For the human being does not have a body there and is not subject to the physical laws of this world which we live in between birth and death. So we speak there of the play of forces from soul to soul. You can read in my Theosophy that in the soul world, in the life between death and a new birth, we have to speak of the forces of sympathy and antipathy, active from one soul to another. This activity is of an absolutely inner kind. Through antipathy, one soul confronts another, and through sympathy, pain is soothed. Harmonies and disharmonies arise between the soul's innermost experiences. This relationship between the innermost experiences of one soul and another is what makes up the actual situation in the supersensible world. What one soul can experience in another, in this physical world, in the course of physical life, is only a reflection of those supersensible happenings, what still remains of them, so to speak. This reflection, however, must be judged in the right light. We can ask how, with reference to social life, we are to judge what we live through here between birth and death when compared to supersensible life. Having often thought about the necessity of threefolding the social order, our attention is immediately drawn to the middle sphere, which has often been described the actual political state. People who in our time have reflected on this political state have been constantly endeavoring to understand what it is. But you know, present-day people with their materialistic ideas really have no proper basis on which to consider something of this nature. Furthermore, in recent times, all sorts of things have been fused together with the modern state, according to the various class interests, so that it is pretty well impossible to tell whether the state is a reality and not a living lie. There is a vast contrast between the outlook of the German philosopher Hegel and the very different outlook which Fritz Mothner, the writer of a philosophical dictionary, has recently made known. Hegel regards the state more or less as the realization of God on earth. Fritz Mauthner says that the state is a necessary evil, but one that is indispensable, an essential of social life. These are radically opposed views of two prominent men of recent times. A great deal that formerly came about instinctively is now being raised into consciousness, and therefore all kinds of people have endeavored to form ideas of what the state should be like and how it ought to be shaped. These ideas have appeared in every shade of the spectrum. On the one hand, there are the ones who fight shy of getting down to the nitty-gritty of it, yet want to give it a form whereby people who have lots of complaints to make get the least chance of saying anything. And then there are others who want to make radical changes to enable people to create a satisfying existence. The question is, how can we actually arrive at a conception of what the state really is? If you consider impartially what can come into play between one person and another in the context of the state, and compare this with my description of what comes into play between one soul and another in supersensible existence, then and only then do you acquire a perception of the reality of the state, of its potential reality. For the relationship based on the fundamental forces of sympathy and antipathy in the human soul in supersensible existence is of the most inward nature, whereas the kind of relation between one person and another founded in the domain of the political state is of the most external nature. It is based on the law, which is the realm where people confront one another in the most distant manner. If you follow this thought through, you arrive at the insight that the state is the exact opposite of supersensible life. It is truest to its own nature, this state, the more completely it is the opposite of supersensible life, the less it presumes in any way to include in its composition anything that belongs to supersensible life. The more it focuses on mutual human relationships based on the most external matters, those in which everyone is equal, equal in the eyes of the law, we become more and more profoundly convinced of the fact that it is the state's real nature to cover only those areas that belong to our life between birth and death, those that belong to the most external realm of our existence. If that is the case, we have to ask if the state is an image of supersensible life solely because it represents its opposite. How does the supersensible realm find its way into the rest of our life in the sense world? In the last lecture, I spoke of this from another point of view. Today, I would like to add that the antipathies which develop in the supersensible world during the period between death and birth leave traces behind, which we bring with us through birth into physical existence. These come face to face with everything that lives in so-called spiritual cultural life. This is what draws people together in religious communities and other common cultural interests, so that they can bring balance into the traces of antipathies which have lingered on from the life before birth. All our spiritual culture should be a realm for itself, because it is an echo of our pre-earthly life, and, as it were, sends us into the sense world, equipped to form a kind of remedy for the leftover antipathies coming from the supersensible world. This is why it is so dreadful when human beings bring about splits in their spiritual cultural life instead of uniting with one another as ought to happen in spiritual life. The echoes of the antipathies left over from spiritual life before birth churn about in the depths of the human soul and prevent our goals from coming to realization. For what we should be aiming for is true spiritual harmony, real spiritual collaboration. Where there should be harmony, cliques arise. This inclination to sectarianism and schisms is the sign of the remaining antipathies from which all spiritual life arises and for which spiritual cultural life should really become the cure. We should recognize that spiritual life has an inner connection to our pre-earthly life, is in a way related to supersensible life. We should therefore not be tempted to set up this spiritual cultural life as anything else than an independent activity outside the jurisdiction of the state, which is not an echo in the same sense, but a counter image of the supersensible life. And we shall only really understand the essence of both the state and spiritual cultural life if we take supersensible life into account, as well as the life of the senses. Actual reality requires both of these, for the life of the senses on its own is nothing more than a dream. Economic life is quite different. In economic life, one person works for another. People do this because each one finds it to his advantage. Economic life arises from needs and consists in the satisfying of needs through working on all those things on the physical plane which can satisfy both the ordinary natural needs of human beings as well as those more delicate needs of the soul, which are still of an instinctive kind. In economic life, on an unconscious level, something develops which works on beyond death. The work people do for one another out of the egotistic needs of economic life brings about, beneath the surface, the makings of certain sympathies which we have to develop further during the life after death. In the same way, a spiritual cultural life is a kind of cure for the remains of antipathies, which we bring into earthly life from our pre-earthly existence. What is going on beneath the surface of economic life is filled with potential for the development of sympathies that will develop after death. This is another aspect, again, of the way we can learn from the spiritual world to recognize the need for a threefolding of the social order. No one can, of course, reach this point of view unless he works at acquiring a spiritual scientific basis for an understanding of the cosmos. But for anyone who does this, it will become more and more obvious that life requires that if the social organism is to be sound, it must be divided into these three branches. For when compared together, they each have quite a different relationship to supersensible reality, which, as I have said, is the complement to the sense world, and together with it makes up true reality. But over the past few centuries, nobody has spoken about the aspects of outer physical existence that manifest in spiritual cultural life, the life of the state, and economic life. People have gone on churning out old traditions, but they still do not understand them. They have lost the habit of taking a direct way through an active soul life into the land of the spirit in search of the light that is able to illumine physical reality, without which our physical reality cannot be properly understood. The leading circles among humanity have, of course, set the tone for this unspiritual life. This accounts for the deep gulf which has arisen between the social classes, a gulf which can be found at the very foundations of our life today, and which we really should be awake to. Perhaps I may persist in calling to mind how before July and August 1914, people who belonged to the leading classes, the former leading classes, were full of praise for the heights which our civilization, as they called it, had finally attained. They spoke of how thought could be conveyed over long distances at lightning speed by the telegraph and telephone systems, and of other fabulous achievements of modern technology, which have brought such wonderful progress to civilization and culture. But this life of civilization and culture was based on the very foundations which have produced the frightful catastrophes of today. Prior to July and August 1914, the European statesmen, especially those of Central Europe, and there are documents to prove this, declared time without number. According to the present situation, peace in Europe is assured for a long time to come. This is literally what the statesmen of Central Europe, especially, said in their party speeches. I could show you speeches made as late as May 1914, in which it was stated, "Our diplomatic measures have achieved the kind of interrelationships between the various states which give us the chance to believe in a lasting peace." That was in May 1914. But if you saw through the situation at that time, you had to speak differently. In lectures I gave in Vienna at that time, which was before the war, I stated what I have often repeated in the course of recent years. We are living in the midst of something which can only be called a cancer of our human social life, a carcinoma of the social order. This carcinoma has now burst and become what people call the world war. At that time, the remark, "We are living in a carcinoma, in a social tumor," was taken by people to be mere words because the world war was still to come. They had no idea that they were dancing on a volcano. The reaction is still the same today if you draw their attention to the other volcano, which is real enough and is awaiting us in what is only now taking shape, in what people have for a long time been calling the social question. Because people are so fond of being asleep to reality, they do not hit on the idea of realizing that within this very reality lie the actual forces which alone can turn it into a true reality. This is why it is so difficult to bring home to present-day people the urgent necessity to work towards a threefolding of the social order. For a division into the three branches belongs to a healthy social organism. What is the difference between a way of thinking that comes to expression in this demand for a threefold social order and other ways of thinking? These other ways of thinking actually consist in thinking up what might be the best social world order for us and what we ought to do to arrive at it. Notice what the difference is between this kind of thinking and the kind which is at the foundation of the threefolding of the social organism. The threefold social order does not start by asking what is the best way of arranging the social organism. On the contrary, it starts from reality by asking, how do we classify human beings themselves so that they take their place in the social order in an unrestricted way and can work together so that the right thing comes about? This way of thinking does not hinge on principles or theories or social dogmas, but on the nature of the human being. It says, place people in the environment of a threefold social order, and they will themselves say how it should be organized. This way of thinking takes its lead from what is really human and not from abstract theories or abstract social dogmas. If a human being were to live in isolation, he would never develop human speech. Human speech can only arise in a social community. On the same premise, a human being does not, by himself, develop a social way of thinking, nor have any social perceptions or social instincts. Only in the right community is it possible to bring social life into present-day events. But a great many things contradict this. Because of the rise of materialism in recent centuries, humankind has taken leave of true reality, become alienated from it. In their inner being, human beings have become lonely. And most lonely of all are the ones who have been torn from life and are connected with nothing but barren machines. With the factory on the one hand and the soulless capitalism on the other. The human soul itself has become barren. But out of this soul, something can struggle to break free from a human being's own individual personality. What can come forth from a person's own individual being are spiritual thoughts, spiritual perceptions of the supersensible world. Perceptions which also throw light on the external world of nature. It is precisely when we are really lonely, when we are thrown back entirely on ourselves, that we are in the best frame of mind as an individual to acquire knowledge about our relationship with the world of nature and the world of spirit. What we should be acquiring in the way of social thinking is the opposite of this. Only if we reflect on this can we form a proper judgment of the significant moment in history in which we are now living. It was necessary for humanity to go through this historic moment of loneliness in the course of world evolution, so that out of their loneliness of soul, people could develop spiritual life. The loneliest of all were the great thinkers, who appeared to live in heights of total abstraction. Yet in their abstractions, they were only seeking the path to the supersensible world. Human beings, of course, must not only seek the path to the supersensible world and to nature, but out of their own thoughts, they must seek the path leading to social life. However, as social life cannot be developed alone, but only through really experiencing other people, the lonely people of our modern age are not exactly the best suited to develop social thinking. Just when they came to the point of wanting to attain something worthwhile by means of their inner forces, the results of their efforts turned out to be antisocial, not social thinking at all. People's present-day inclinations and longings are the outcome of spiritual forces arrived at in loneliness and are given a false direction by the overwhelming influence of Ahrimanic materialism. The importance of this fact really strikes you if you ask yourself something which fills many people today with horror. Suppose you ask them, whom would you call the Bolshevists? Lenin, Trotsky, they say. Well, I know of another one, not living in the immediate presence, though, and he is none other than the German philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte. you will have come across quite a lot about Fichte's idealistic and spiritual way of thinking. But this is less likely to have made you aware of the sort of person Fichte was than his well-known views expressed in his booklet On a Closed Economy, which can be bought very cheaply in the Reclame edition. Compare the way Fichte thinks of how the social order ought to be arranged for the masses with what Trotsky or Lenin write, and you will discover a remarkable agreement. You will then begin to become distrustful of merely regarding a thing and judging it by external appearances, and will be tempted to ask, what is actually behind this? If you look at it more closely and try to understand what is behind it, you will arrive at the following. You will investigate the distinctive spiritual orientation of the most radical minds of today. You may look into the particular soul characteristics of people such as Trotsky and Lenin, their special way of thinking and forms of thought. And then you ask yourself, how have such people become conceivable? And the answer is, you can imagine them first in a different social setting, and then in ours, which for centuries now has been developing into what it has become in the light, or more exactly, in the darkness of materialism. Supposing Lenin and Trotsky had been part of a different social order, how might they have turned out when developing their spiritual forces in quite a different way? As profound mystics, for in a religious atmosphere, what lived in their souls might have developed into the most profound mysticism. You can see what it became under the influence of modern materialism. If you look into Johann Gottlieb Fichte's book, you will see that it is the social ideal of a person who really and truly was endeavoring his utmost to tread the highest paths of knowledge, and who developed the kind of thinking that constantly tended towards the supersensible world. However, when he tried to work out for himself a social ideal, even though it came entirely from his heart, we see that the very thing that suits us when we pursue for ourselves the highest ideals of knowledge is a handicap when applied to the kind of social thinking necessary for working in social life. The kind of spiritual work Fichte did requires to be done alone, whereas social thinking has to be worked at in a community of other human beings, where the chief task of the thinker is to consider how the social organism might be laid out so that people may work together in the right way to found a social existence within the social realm itself. This is why I never tell you or tell the people of today, this is how you should deal with the private property with regard to the means of production, or communal property with regard to the means of production. But I have to say, endeavor to work towards dividing the social organism into its three spheres. Then what is affected by capital will be managed by the spiritual sphere, and the life of rights will be administered by the political state. Then the sphere of rights and the organizational sphere will dovetail properly into the economic sphere. And the kind of socialization will then occur, which, in accordance with certain legal concepts, will see to it that whatever a person earns over and above his needs shall be constantly channeled into the spiritual cultural system. It returns again to the spiritual cultural sphere. Nowadays, this arrangement applies only in the realm of intellectual property, where nobody finds it strange. A person cannot keep his intellectual property for his descendants for more than a certain period. 30 years after his death at most. Then it becomes public property. We ought to think of this as a possible model for the channeling back of surplus profit into the social organism, even if it is the result of individual effort. And also channeling back what is covered by the capitalist system. The only question is, into which areas? Into that area which can take care of the individual capacities of people, whether spiritual or otherwise. That is, into the spiritual cultural realm. Things will be managed this way when people take their rightful place in the social organism. This is what this way of thinking will lead to. I could imagine these things being done differently every century. In such matters, no arrangements are valid for all time. But in our era, people have got to get used to judging every... No, sorry. But in our era, people have got used to judging everything from a materialistic point of view. So nothing is seen any longer in its right light. I have often pointed out that in modern times, labor has become a commodity. Ordinary work contracts are based on this. They are based on the amount of work the laborer does for his employer. A healthy relationship cannot arise if the contract is settled in terms of so much labor. For labor must be treated as a rights question settled by the political state on the basis of the goods produced being divided between those who do the physical work and those who do the intellectual work. The contract can be made solely on the goods produced and not on the relationship of laborer and employer. This is the only way to put the matter on a healthy footing. But people ask, where do the social evils associated with capitalism come from? They say they come from the capitalist economic system. But no evils can arise from an economic system. They arise in the first place because we have no real labor laws to protect labor. And secondly, because we fail to notice that the way the workers are denied their due share amounts to a living lie. But why are they being deprived? Not because of the economic system, but because the social order itself allows the possibility of the individual capacities of the employer to be unjustly rewarded at the expense of the workers. The division of the proceeds ought to be made in terms of goods, for these are the joint product of the intellectual workers and the laborers. But if by virtue of your individual capacities you take something from someone which you have no right to take, what are you doing? You're cheating him, taking advantage of him. You have only to look these circumstances straight in the face to realize that the trouble does not lie in capitalism, but in the misuse of intellectual, i.e. spiritual, capacities. Here you have the connection with the spiritual world. If you start by making the spiritual organization healthy so that spiritual intellectual capacities are no longer permitted to take advantage of those who have to labor, then you will be bringing health into the social organism as a whole. It all depends on being able to see what is the right thing to do in every case. To do this, human beings need guiding principles. Today, we have reached the point in time where proper guiding principles can only come from spiritual life. Therefore, we have to give our serious attention to this spiritual life. And it has to be pointed out again and again that nowadays it is not enough to keep on declaring. People must recapture a belief in the Spirit. Oh, plenty of prophets are beginning to believe and speak of the necessity of believing in the Spirit. But the point is not merely to say, in order to be cured of the present unhealthy conditions, people will have to turn from materialism back to the Spirit. No, mere belief in the Spirit is no cure for today. However many illustrious prophets go around repeating people must become spiritual, however many prophets say, up to now the Christ has only been the concern of our private life, now he should enter the life of the state. Saying things of this sort achieve absolutely nothing today. For what matters now is not merely to believe in the Spirit, but to be filled with the Spirit to the point where we shall be the very people who bring the Spirit into outer material reality. The essential thing today is not to tell people to believe in the Spirit, but to speak of the kind of Spirit which is really able to master material reality, which is really able to tell us how we should organize the social organism. For the cause of the unspiritual character of the present day is not that human beings do not believe in the Spirit, but that they cannot enter into the kind of connection with the Spirit that would enable the Spirit to seize hold of the matter of real life. Lack of faith in the Spirit does not come solely from denying the Spirit. It can also come from the assumption that matter is unspiritual. How many people are there today who imagine they are highly superior when they say, oh, look how unspiritual outer material existence is. We ought to withdraw from it. We must turn away from external material life to the secluded life of the Spirit. Down here is material reality, where you use the coupons in your ration book. Then you sit down to meditate and off you go to the spiritual world. Two beautifully distinct ways of living, sharply distinguished. But this is not what it is all about. The essential thing is that the Spirit should become so strong in people's innermost souls that it does not merely aspire to talk about things such as grace and salvation, but enters right into what we have to do in outer material reality, that we enable the Spirit to flow into this external material reality. To acquire the habit of talking about the Spirit comes very easily to people. And in this connection, some people can contradict themselves in an extraordinary way. Anton Gruber's dramatic personification of the human being who denies God is an illustration of this. Special emphasis is given to the denial by using the words, as truly as there is God in heaven, I am an atheist. There are inconsistent people around today in no small numbers, even though they may not draw attention to themselves in such a striking way, but it is a common style today to use expressions such as truly as there is a God in heaven, I am an atheist. This sort of thing most certainly conveys a warning. Not to think that mere belief in the Spirit is enough, but to try more than anything else to find the Spirit in a way that will make us strong enough also to penetrate into outer material reality. Then people will really stop using the word spirit, spirit, spirit in every sentence and show instead, by the way they regard things, that they bring spirit into their observation. The essential thing today is that we look at things in the light of the Spirit and not only talk about spirit. People need to understand this so that anthroposophical spiritual science is in no way confused with all the superficial talk about spirit, which is so popular nowadays. Again and again, when some Sunday afternoon preacher of the worldly sort has merely spoken in a better style than usual, you hear someone saying that it sounds just like anthroposophy. In fact, it is usually the opposite. This is precisely what we have to keep a wakeful eye on. This is what it is all about. If you understand this, then you will be very close to the insight that such a well-intentioned statement, I might say a statement spoken out of the presentiment of tragic death, as the one I quoted from Kurt Eisner, is particularly valuable because it strikes one as being someone's confession. Quote, "To be honest, I don't seriously believe in a supersensible element. At least I have no wish to give it any active attention. Yet those who speak about the world of the supersensible have always said, the reality we perceive here with our senses is only half reality. It is like a dream. I have only to look at the form this sense reality has taken on in social life of today, and it does indeed look like a dream. The fact is, one is driven to say that this reality is clearly the invention of some evil spirit." Unquote. Certainly, this confession of Kurt Eisner is remarkable. But might it not signify something else? Might not this terrible and tragic manner in which present-day reality is being presented to us be an educative gesture of a good spirit urging us to seek true reality in what appears as a frightful nightmare, to seek the wholeness of reality, which is compounded of the sense-perceptible dimension and the supersensible dimension? We must not take an exclusively pessimistic view of the present time. We can also draw from it the strength to achieve a kind of vindication of contemporary existence, in which case we should never again allow ourselves to stop short at the level of the sense perceptible, but will have to find the way out of it to the supersensible level. For anyone who refuses to seek this way out would have to be pretty dim-witted, not to say this kind of reality is the invention of an evil spirit. But anyone who musters the will to rise from this kind of reality to spiritual reality will also be able to speak in terms of our being taught by a good spirit. And despite all that we see today, we may nevertheless rest assured that humankind will find their way out of the tragic destiny of the present time. But we must, of course, respond to the clear pointer calling us to play our part in social healing. This is what I wanted to add today to what I said recently.